Good morning, party people, and welcome to Office Hours, the show where I answer your Microsoft data platform questions. You can ask your own questions over at pollgab.com/room/Brento. Got a few folks, Spitfire and Surly Dev, in the house because I'm going live way early in the morning. It's like 3:30 a.m. Vegas time. And I've been up since 1 a.m. Vegas time. I just have the world's most goofy body clock. I am all over the place. I used to work night audit in hotels. So in night audit, when you work in hotels, that's 11 p.m. to 7 a.m. When I did that, my body clock didn't do me any good. Like, I'd be fine, like 1 a.m. to 4 p.m. But as the 5, 6 a.m. approached, man, I was just absolutely screwed. I would just, you know, be ready to fall asleep. Who knows what's going to happen on today's body clock episode of, you know, how Brent's sleep schedule works. Surly Dev says, I'm a European living in the United States. This is what worked out so well for me when I went to Iceland. When I lived in Iceland during the pandemic, it was so convenient because during the winter, it was dark 24/7. So it didn't really matter when I was awake or when I was asleep. And in the summer, it was light 24/7. So it didn't really matter when I was awake or when I was asleep. Oh, I loved that so much. It was so spectacular. If I could make it work where I lived over there full time, I would do it in a heartbeat. I absolutely loved living over there, especially seeing the change of seasons, seeing how the change of seasons were marked with the weather, you know, and you would see the days change, you would see the whole country come to life as the countryside turned green and flowers would spurt up by the side of the road. It was just absolutely fantastic. Really, really enjoyed that. So to some of the questions I have to warn you inside here are going to be of dubious quality. Some of the questions inside here, y'all who are regulars on the stream know that I give the same answer very often, which is, what is the problem that you're trying to solve? I probably need to figure out how, or maybe I need to get Richie to code that before people post a question, it asks them, what's the problem that you're trying to solve? So that it kind of forces them to step back and think bigger picture. And I'll give you an example, starting with the very first question out there. The top voted question out there from My Eric is Strong says, do you suggest any steps after an upgrade to SQL Server 2022 in particular? I mean 2022 features to try, enjoy, or tweak. I'm not asking for generic migration advice. So here's the thing. Change equals risk. Change equals risk. Change equals risk. This is an important thing to be aware of when you're working with database applications. Anytime that you make a change, you are running a risk that things are going to perform better. You're also running a risk that things are going to perform worse. There is no one best practice, turn this feature on and everything will go faster. There are buttons you can push to make some things go faster, but they can also make other things go slower. So, of course, I want to make sure that whatever buttons you push, they're going to make things universally faster altogether. Otherwise, you're just introducing unpredictability into your environment. Don't do that. Instead, take a step back and say, what's the problem that I need to solve? What is it that your users are saying? This part is slow. This part is having a problem. And if your users are saying everything is slow, then you don't have a feature thing you need to change. You have a hardware thing or an index thing or a query tuning thing that you need to work on. Typically, it's a hardware thing if they say everything is slow. So hopefully that gives you advice. That's why there's some chapter in the Microsoft Books Online inside the documentation that says, as soon as you upgrade, turn this feature on. If there was something like that, it would just be built into the product, right? It's not like they would make it a switch. They would just make it so that when you upgraded, everything got better. They would build it directly into the product, but of course they don't do that. They gatekeep things behind switches because there are risks whenever you upgrade. So there you go. Next up, next question asks, do you suggest any, or I'm sorry, next question asks, all of my SQL VMs only run SQL Server. How do I know when it's time to turn on lock pages in memory? How can I know that it's safe? So what you want to do is you want to monitor. There's a perfmon counter called available megabytes, memory available megabytes, which will tell you at the operating system level how much memory is free. You want to start by looking at that and make sure that you have plenty of memory available at all times. When I say at all times, I would check it for weeks, because I've seen so many issues where people will periodically remote desktop into the SQL Server and they'll run some application that's a memory hog. They will drag and drop files from one place to another. They'll be like, oh, I just need to copy this backup out, not understanding how Windows uses memory for file caching. So if you can guarantee that you have plenty of available memory, and at the same time, as long as you're adding perfmon counters to monitor, I would also monitor the perfmon counter for remote desktop sessions open. And anytime that number is anything other than zero, you want to start asking questions about why that is. Because if someone's remote desktoping in, I guarantee you they're running applications that use memory. So if you got plenty of available memory over the course of weeks and no one's remote desktoping into the SQL Server, then you could turn on lock pages in memory. Why? Why? Because if you have lots of available memory and no one's remote desktoping in, the pages are in memory already. So what good does it do you? Next up, That's Not Chocolate asks, on our Azure SQL databases, I discovered that most of the compatibility levels are 140 and 150. I'd like to try to move to 160, hoping it'll make queries run faster. Is this a false hope? So the cool thing is that you can do that with query hints. If you have a query that you want to test, there are query hints for which compatibility level you want to use. So you can opt in at the query level to compat level 160. The reason why I would try it with query hints first is that if you don't test all of the queries in your workload, you're going to find that some can work slower instead of faster. Change equals risk. So I don't want to just change just for the sake of changing and blindly hoping things will work faster, because they probably will not across the board universally. Some stuff will work faster. Some stuff that used to be fast can now be slower. So try opting in at the query level. If that works, great. Use that query hint, and then those queries that you're concerned about will be faster without you having to test lots of different queries. Next up, Paul asks, we've got multiple clients that outsource their support to us in a shared model, and I'm on the database team. I have limited knowledge of their system design, so how should I troubleshoot when they report that the database is slower than usual so I can suggest next steps? Oh, that's interesting. So you're a consultant who does the same kind of work that I do, and you've sold your services saying you know what you're doing, and now you want me to teach you how to do the same thing that I do that you probably underbid me on. It's an interesting approach. And I bet you want me to do it for free, don't you? That's why you're asking this question at office hours. Wonder what my answer is going to be. So it just so happens that I sell training classes. If you go to brentozar.com and click training up at the top, you can learn how to do the job that you sold your customers and said you could do the same thing Brent Ozar does for less money. You can actually learn how to do that. Am I going to teach you how to do that for free? Next question, please. My Tea Got Cold asked, your post resonated with me about RDBA's doomed to misery. My experience is that any DBA job means job opening means the estate is unhealthy and it will probably take years of pain in order to fix. Is it worth it? Is it worth it comes down to how much are you getting paid? Wouldn't it be cool if people would offer us jobs to sit back and do nothing and not have to work very hard? So those kinds of jobs do exist, but they're called hobbies. If you would like something easy and relaxing, pick up a hobby. But if you want to do work, that's what jobs are. It's fun. It's really funny. I had a discussion with my stepmom at one point. My stepmom was like just totally venting. She'd been working for a couple of different companies for like 20 years altogether. And she's like, I just hate going into work every morning. It's just draining. And, you know, I'm like, so let's drill down. What is it that's draining? And the more that we drilled down, it wasn't her coworkers or her manager. It was the work that she had to do. And I was like, oh, okay. So in a different world, in a different universe, is there any way that that work could be made enjoyable? Could you make a game out of it or something like that? And she was like, oh, it's just a lot of labor. And I'm like, that's what a job is, that it's labor. They say do what you love and you'll never work a day in your life. That's BS, because if you do what you love, there are a few people out there, I'm sure, who get to, you know, basically play for work. I like to think that I'm one of them, but I still end up having a lot of work that's just work. Next up, Chandwich asks, I've worked with SQL Server and T-SQL for 6 years. I blog, I post on LinkedIn, but I can't land a DBA job. At 28, I'm considering data engineering or DevOps instead. How do young professionals break into DBA or consulting roles today? Okay, so one or two things. So if you mentioned consulting roles, if you want consulting roles and you don't have a network of people who are already like willing to hire you, then you're going to have a really hard time. What you want to do is work for a consulting company instead. And in those, the consulting company will bring you the work. Now, you don't make as much money if you're working for someone else as a consultant. But the cool part is that you don't have to do any of your own sales and marketing. There are terrible consulting jobs out there where they're like, we'll hire you as a consultant, but you got to bring in your own sales. And I'm like, well, that's not working for someone else. That's like working for yourself, but it's the worst of both worlds. You don't get all the money and you have to do all of the work. But if you're not good at bringing in leads, working for a larger consulting company is the way that people get started breaking into that. In terms of breaking into a DBA role, I hate to say this, but you want to get a job doing something else. You want to get a job working as a developer, data engineer, systems administrator, whatever, and then segue your work into your first official DBA role. It's extremely rare that people will hire a DBA who's never had DBA before on their resume. If you don't have a job title that says DBA, getting the first one is damn near impossible. It's much easier to do that via promotion from inside a company where they already know you and trust you and you've exhibited expertise. It's not the answer that anybody wants to hear, but that's just the reality. It's kind of like saying, how would I get a job as a doctor? Now, with doctors, of course, they have schools that give them certifications that say you are certified to be a doctor. You have passed these, you know, well agreed upon tests. The problem is we just don't have that for database administration, and we never really have. Now, Microsoft certifications don't do that function. They focus more on marketing of the things that Microsoft wants you to know, but doesn't have anything really to do with your expertise as a real world database administrator, sadly. Not a SQL question asks, sorry if this is too off topic, but your travels have me wondering, of all the places you haven't been to, what's top of the list to visit? Real high up on there is an overwater bungalow, so like Bora Bora or the Maldives, just some island in the middle of nowhere where you're on these over idyllic waters and you have this little bungalow where you can wake up in the morning and just walk down into the ocean and, you know, enjoy yourself. I've always wanted to do that. That's really high up on the list. Also high up on the list is the North Pole and South Pole. I would love to go to the North Pole and South Pole. I'm aiming to do an Antarctic. I've wanted to do an Antarctic cruise for forever, but they're really time consuming to do it right. There are these little like checkbox cruises that are like 7 days long from South America, and they just kind of loop around and just touch, you don't get to get off on anywhere near McMurdo or anything like that. I want to go to McMurdo. I want to go to the South Pole because I already love, really cold environments. I think they're really pretty to visit. Living there is kind of a stretch. Like, I liked living in Iceland because it was a mix of warm and cold. But yeah, definitely those are the tops of the list there. Next up, That's Not Chocolate asks, a few queries are very slow and they present sometimes locking and blocking. After investigation, I found that some of the tables involved have over 1,000 columns wide. Could column store indexes be the low-hanging fruit for now while we normalize the database? No, if you are because locking and blocking, typically when people say that, it's inserts, updates, and deletes. Usually that's mixed in the workload that it's two writes that are blocking each other. If you're having problems with writes and reads, then you want to check out RCSI, Read Committed Snapshot Isolation. If you go to brentosr.com/go/RCSI, we've got a great write-up on there with resources about how you go about learning that and implementing it. But if you're thinking that you're going to reduce blocking between two writers, column store is probably not going to be the answer that you want. Despite the fact that each column is stored independently, the problem that you're going to run into is that when you try to update rows, SQL Server won't know what row group they're in. You can learn more about that in my Column Store Fundamentals class. Honestly, though, I wouldn't take that. Take my word that Column Store isn't going to be the solution for you. If you don't believe me, go spend, $90 on my Column Store class, but otherwise, go hit brentosr.com/go/RCSI. That one's totally free, so go hit that one instead. Let's see, next up, talking of travel, Simon Fraser says, Brent, late last year, I mentioned how much I'd love to see SQL Cruise make a return, and you hinted that you might be working on something similar, although more geared toward consultants. I was wondering if that idea has gained any traction since then. No. There are so many things that I want to do. You can't see it from here, but I have a whiteboard in my office with like the big picture priorities for the things that I need to work on in the next quarter, just to make sure that I focus on those and execute rather than getting too distracted by stuff. That like vacation for consultants thing has not been able to bubble up to the top. Because it is a lot of work and limited revenue, like I'm not going to make any money on it. I'll lose money when I go do it. But yeah, it's something that's on the back of my mind. I just don't see it happening probably until at least 2027. I tend to think kind of long term. Next up, Dario says, "Have Brent, have you ever experienced a problem with multiple OpenJSON evaluations in a query? We change it temporarily to a where clause and speeds it up. Unfortunately, we need this." Yeah, unfortunately, that's the reality of OpenJSON. It was not designed for performance. If you want to make JSON queries go fast, what you want to look into is computed columns. Computed columns and index those. So if you search for like SQL Server how to index JSON columns in then look at the results that are in there. There are several bloggers who've written about how to do that with computed columns. I believe 2025 will make it much easier. The thing about me saying I believe, so the problem is that 2025 isn't out yet. And Microsoft has had this problem where they've yanked some features right before release. The JSON indexes feature looks complex enough, like it's a totally different new set of indexes, that I wouldn't bank on that until it actually releases. I'm not saying there's a known problem with it. I'm just saying that it's a super complex feature that I haven't seen anybody really bang on yet. So I just would not want you to hold out all hope for that and instead look at the computed columns technique instead. Next up, we have Culloden, who says, "My company is looking to hire some BI consultants to design new analytics environments. I've lost the fabric battle. What questions would you ask consultants when interviewing them for potential work?" Number one, far and away, references. You want to talk to other companies that they've used for similar projects, similar scope, similar amount of work, then go ask those companies and say, how did the project go? Did it finish on time? Has it finished? Did it finish on time? Were you happy with the results of it? What did your ballpark budget look like? What are your users complaining about? Have they got any complaints about how the project went? And you want to talk to at least two people at the company. Because at any given company, whenever a consultant gets involved, there's a personal champion for that consultant. There's a person who bet their reputation at that company on that consultant. And that person will always give glowing reviews because that consultant's success is very important to that person because they bet their reputation on it. Talk to at least two. There may be two champions inside there, but I want to at least reduce the chance that you're talking to just the one gushing person who went over the top. So that's where I would start. I would say the same thing for two. Anytime you do a transaction with a vendor, because I've seen this go wrong with hardware, with software, with custom development type stuff, where companies have gone strictly off of the consultant's word or off of the vendor's word. And then really seen this a lot with brand new hardware where some hardware startup will come in and they're like, we'll revolutionize your database storage. And then the company goes to use it and they're like, oh my God, you know, performance is terrible. What's going on with this? And then they bring me in thinking that it's a SQL Server problem. And I'll, you know, look and the performance is atrocious. And I'll just say to the hardware vendor, okay, cool. So in this case, this is a 2 terabyte database. Have you ever had any other clients successfully implement a 2 terabyte database on your platform? Let's talk to them and find out what it is that we're missing. You know, was there something about their hardware that was different than ours or settings that were different, et cetera? And then that's when all of a sudden the vendor will collapse and be like, oh, well, we can't let you talk to anyone else. Okay, so buddy, that means you don't have anybody else. So that's the end of that one. Next up, Fuzzy asks, in the cloud consulting world, what are your pros and cons about acquiring deep knowledge in a specific database technology versus broader and more shallow knowledge across multiple database technologies? I can't claim ownership for this. This quote comes from Buck Woody, and I'm sure he heard it from someone else based on the dude has an incredible amount of exposure to all kinds of industries. In a mature technology, dive deep, be specific and specialize. In an immature market, go general. So what that means is, for example, if you're working with SQL Server or Oracle or MySQL or Postgres, if you're working with anything that's been out for 10, 15, 20 years, you can afford to go very deep in one specific part of it. However, if you're working with brand new technologies and or immature markets, and I'm going to use an example that you're not working in, but it'll ring a bell, large language models. So if you're working with AI, if you're working with ChatGPT, Claude, Google Gemini, if you're working with any of those, that market is changing so fast. New LLMs come out every 6 months. You don't want to tie up all of your knowledge in one specific vendor. You want to get experience across lots of vendors because you don't know which one's going to win. And there may not be one winner for a decade, like you may be jumping back and forth between multiple technologies for a decade. Let's see, next up. Oh, speaking of AI, Avi asks, hi, Brent, how do you see database development changing with AI? We're seeing lots of AI tools that are able to provide good database designs and SQL queries. So, Avi, what I would say there is if you think that the current tools are providing good database design and SQL queries, I don't think you're drilling as deep as you probably should. They produce what looks like amazing designs. But as soon as you drill a little deeper, I'll give you an example from a client that I actually went on site with probably 2 months ago. They used ChatGPT to design an entire new database for them. And we spent 4 days, I think, fixing that database. And they hadn't gone live or anything yet, but we were just looking from one table to the next. Is that the right way to store customer names? Is that the right way to store product lines? What are the problems that we're going to encounter with our products when we try to load them into those tables? And then that's when, you know, things start to kind of fall apart. I am not saying that AI database tools aren't great. They are a tool just like a power saw or a drill is, but it's just a tool. It's not like it replaces knowledge altogether. You still need to look at the output with a critical eye. I'll tell you, every time that Microsoft has gotten up on the stage at a conference and demoed Copilot, I have watched the T-SQL that it generates, and I'm like, that's not right, that's not right, that's not right. And I'm going to give you an example just because it always pops at me when I see it fly by on the stage, gender. I get that there's a passionate argument out there about how you should store gender, but the wrong answer would be a bit column. If you see a bit column for gender, that database design ain't done yet. So when you see those create table statements flying by, just take a little bit closer look. A global company with VerCare, for example, in on customer names, that's not going to work. Next up, Rob says, hi, Brent. What's a common approach you've seen for hosting SQL Server databases for vendor applications? Suppose the database is less than 20 gigs. Do you think a dedicated Azure DB on a lower tier could be a good fit for this use case? So it depends on whether you're storing each client in their own database or whether you're trying to put lots of clients in the same database. I think, based on your question, I think you're putting each client in its own database and each one is 20 gigs or less, because vendor applications, I mean, if you're a software as a service provider and you're making a living, if you're trying to put everything in one database for all your clients, it's going to be way larger than 20 gigs. But if it's a software as a service type thing where each client is in its own database, I love using Azure SQL DB for each client. Because what it lets you do is tie costs back to the client. Also, if a client says, we want faster performance, then you can charge them for that. You can say, okay, to go up to the next tier, here's what that would look like. I have some software vendors who will also have like Premier clients or Cadillac clients that they want to make sure get a really, really good experience. So what they'll do is they'll foot the bill internally to pop them up to a really high service tier up in Azure SQL DB, knowing that they may need to pass that cost on to the client later on, for example. It's really good for accounting type stuff. Let's see here. We'll do one more. JRL says, I'm thinking about transitioning from working on database performance to a broader performance engineer career. With the limited facts I've given, does this strike you as a bad idea? I have no idea why you're doing it, whether you're doing it because you're good at database engineering or you're bad at performance. Because let's think about this for a second. If you're good at database engineering, why would you transition to a more jack-of-all-trades career? You've specialized, and now you're thinking about going to a generalist. When you go to a generalist, you're competing with more people for lower rates. I don't think that's a great idea. Or if you think you're going to get higher rates, I'd be curious as to why. If you're leaving database engineering because you're bad at it, and you go, well, you know what, I don't really know that much, and I don't mean bad like you suck. I mean like you just don't have the knowledge necessary to do it. You're like, man, I keep hitting walls at database engineering, but I seem to be good at more general systems type stuff. Well, then by all means, go make the switch, you know, do something that you love and that you think is that you're going to succeed at. But I'd have to know a whole lot more about why you're making that switch. All right, so there is a good round of questions there. Let's take a break here. I'm going to go off and go get me some fresh coffee and go switch over to my day job, quote unquote. Holy smokes, it's still like 4 a.m. here. So hopefully y'all had fun and learned something, and I will see y'all on the next Office Hours. Adios.